Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Welcome to, as they say, For Your Benefit. And we're going to talk about estate planning in divorce and blended families. And who better to lead us in that than Mark Levine? Mark Levine is an attorney, correct, and partner in the firm Handler and Levine, with offices in Maryland, Virginia,
yep.
Okay. All righty. And Mark's been on the show many times before. I think you'll find his responses clear, crisp, and not elongated, so you can understand them.
That's a big burden for a lawyer to have to.
You got it mastered, though. All righty. So estate planning in divorce and blended families. Actually, if you don't mind, we got a good email, I think, that just jumps right into this. And this is from our friend on the West Coast. And he says, and this is parroting a person. I'm a federal employee who recently got divorced. My former spouse has many debts, and I take care of our teenage child. What things should I do to protect myself in the TSP and my federal benefits in order to avoid any more debt? We were married more than 10 years, and I feel he will go after my benefits. Now, this could be a he or a she, so we'll just do the middle ground here. Correct me if I'm wrong. If once somebody's divorced, didn't the former spouse miss the opportunity to latch on to some of the benefits?
Well, I'm happily not a domestic attorney, and I am in awe of good domestic attorneys who can do what they do. And this really is that kind of question. In other words, this is the question of what happened in the divorce, and what did the divorce decree say? What does the separation agreement say? And that is really where those issues were settled. And so they're right, the former spouse's right, as to any of your current benefits, your future benefits, are all tied to what happened in the divorce. Now, in some cases, former spouses can come back and reopen a settlement of some kind based on changed circumstances, unless a divorce decree or separation agreement says that that is not allowed. And so really the first answer for this person is go back and look at your divorce decree, go back and look at your separation agreement, and really go back and talk to your domestic attorney, because that's the person who should have laid out for you what it is that is subject to some sort of payment to your former spouse now or in the future, and or what are the options for that spouse in the future. It's not so much an estate planning issue as it is a domestic issue. What happened during the divorce and when the divorce became final?
Years ago, as a tax accountant type, I used to testify in divorces. It was not long-lived. It was just too gut-wrenching when both attorneys started attacking me. But my job only was to talk about the value of the pension, the annuity in this case. I won't say pension, the annuity, their FERS or their CSRS. And it was back a number of years ago where I'm not so sure a lot of people knew how to calculate the benefit or even understood that there was a benefit. And then when they started understanding, and it just got too cantankerous, I said, I think I'll do something else. But a lot of people didn't know that then. But now I would say in major federal cities, I would hope that the divorce attorney, like you say, would have a feel for it or know where to get the information.
Right. I mean, any divorce attorney who does the work, is a divorce attorney on a regular basis, knows that, hey, we have to deal with the 401k, the TSP, the IRA, and any pension that's out there as part of the divorce process.
Okay, then the divorce is one thing, the estate planning is another. How do you tie the two together? I mean, you craft these documents. Like you say, you don't do the divorce side, but I know you do the estate planning side.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because divorce is one of those things that we always tell clients, you know, when they ask, when do you come back? When do we need to come and see you again? And one of the issues is, you know, marriage, divorce, remarriage, all of those are things where you should be looking at your estate planning documents, because when a couple comes in and does their estate planning together, there are certain assumptions that they're making. They're assuming that they're probably going to be together when these documents become operative. and they're probably going to want the primary person making decisions for them to be their spouse. And so these documents are crafted in a way to create sort of broad powers for each spouse. Now, in a lot of states, there are automatic laws that say upon a divorce, these things change. The power of attorney may be revoked. A healthcare directive may be revoked. A will may be changed based on a divorce. None of those states have anything that says upon a separation or upon thinking about divorce or when you look at that person and say, you're not actually the person I want making decisions for me or perhaps even my children in these circumstances anymore. So the idea of the interplay between divorce and estate planning really starts when you start thinking about, I don't want to be married to this person anymore. Because then you've got to look at what are your documents, what do they say, what kinds of power have I given this person, not just what do they get, but they're probably the person who makes decisions for you if you're incapacitated. So they're going to make legal, financial, healthcare decisions for you. And certainly when you get to the point where you want to separate and sort of go forward towards that divorce, they're probably not the person you want doing that anymore. So while you're still married but not divorced, you can't necessarily say you have no rights anymore to my retirement or to my pension or to my TSP. But you can certainly say you're not going to be that person anymore. And so when you separate, when you go to see the domestic attorney, one of the things you should be looking at is, look, I need to change my power of attorney because if I get hit by a car tomorrow, my former or my now estranged spouse is the person who's set up to make all my decisions for me. And I don't want that anymore. And so you need to look at your documents and say, does this really work based on how our relationship is today? And if not, you need to, even before you've filed papers and perhaps even before you've moved out, go and update those documents so they're no longer your power of attorney and they're no longer your healthcare agent. And they're not the person under your will who makes decisions if something happens to you. Now, often one of the issues is you can't go back to the attorney who did the work for the two of you. When a couple comes in, one of the things we have them do is sign something that says, look, we have no privilege between the three of us. And so you can't come to me and say, look, don't tell my husband, but I'm going to do this. So oftentimes you've got to go to a new person to update these documents and deal with them because the other person, has some conflicts there and they don't just represent you. They're not just your lawyer. They're both parties' lawyer. We have plenty of situations where when the split up is amicable, we have the people come in and say, no, I'm happy. He can still use you and I'll still use you. And both people will sign off and say, I understand. And we're sort of separating our relationship with you now. I also have some clients who say, no, you were my lawyer. I don't want you now being a lawyer for him or for her in a situation where we're now adversarial. So I don't want that.
Probably one of the things that I hear and see articles written about is somebody is married, named the spouse to get X, Y, and Z. Maybe they have the initials TSP, or they have life insurance, or they have the annuity. And the marriage goes sideways, and something doesn't get changed, and then the ex is entitled to something that maybe he or she shouldn't be. Is there a way to word, this beneficiary is fine as long as that person is my current spouse? And if not, I don't know how you would ever do this, but this is a non-attorney asking a real non-attorney question.
I don't think that TSP or FERS or CSRS would respect a designation that says to my wife, if living and if we are married, otherwise too. My guess is that they are going to say, no, you can choose. You can say if they're not alive who it goes to, but we're not going to be responsible for looking to see whether or not you were married at the time you died or what happened. I could be wrong, but we've never really tried to do that. What we tell clients to do is change the designation. Make those changes as part of when you come in and say, look, we've separated. We don't have a separation agreement. We don't have a divorce, but we're living apart and I want to start separating things, changing those designations so that either in some cases, no matter whether you die before or after the divorce, those assets will go where you want, or you know, in terms of when they're ultimately separated. So, for example, the TSP, you can change your designation to the TSP at any point that you want. You're not required to name your spouse, so you can change that. Now, that doesn't mean your spouse won't be entitled to part of that as the divorce settlement, but it does mean that if you die, it's going to go where you want, you know, and certainly upon the divorce, they're going to lose all of their rights. And so rather than waiting to the last minute or waiting till the divorce is final, we recommend let's do the documents now, get them in place so that the moment the divorce becomes final, you don't then have to do them or change them. And that way we can make sure that it's going to be as useful a direction as possible.
So in your practice, is there kind of like a checkup or a checkup letter you send, okay, our annual letter, you know, have you looked at da-da-da-da-da-da, and if there are some issues, give us a buzz?
Sure. I mean, we will send out letters or emails when something big happens, so we're preparing one now because of the changes in the Maryland and now D.C. estate tax, assuming that goes through. And then we send out sort of checkup letters every 3 years saying, hey, come in and let's see what's new and different. Clients almost always ignore that three-year letter. We send out another letter 2 years later, and usually in that 5 to 6 year period, people come in. But again, it also reminds them to look back and say, oh, things are very different for me today than they were, you know, 3 years ago or 5 years ago or anything like that. So we definitely want people to be thinking about what's different in our lives as we go through. And a big one is obviously your marriage.
Great. Then when they come in, do they sometimes come in because of a divorce and they're thinking either clearly or they're not going to get anything? And how do you talk them off the ledge?
So, you know, I've had the entire range of situations. I've actually had people come in and sit down with me and say, so one thing you should know about us ahead of time is we're in the middle of a divorce. And, you know, that kind of set you back for a minute. But what they've decided is they want to make sure that their estate planning for their children is the same. And they want to make sure they have the same trust for their kids and the same trustees and the same guardians. And so they're committed to sort of doing that. And then their individual things might be different, but everything related to their children, they actually still want to do together. And then obviously we have situations where one or the other comes in and says, I want to set something up and I want to make sure that my soon-to-be former spouse has no control over anything. And in fact, I want to empower my trustees, who I'm going to put in charge of my money, to use my money to fight my spouse if necessary. And that's, you know, something that's a little complicated. You create a trust for your child. You die. Your spouse is not automatically the trustee. They're not entitled to be the trustee. You get to put your sister in charge of the trust. But they're going to be the guardian. And they're going to be the ones representing that child's rights vis-a-vis that trust. And so it's important in a situation where you think that may be adversarial, and that's a lot of situations, that you have language that says my trustee has the right to use this money for things that could otherwise be argued aren't really in the children's best interest based on what their guardian thinks is in their best interest. So the right to fight over visitation and the right to fight over guardianship. I have some clients who really don't believe their spouse is safe for their child or appropriate for their child, and they want someone to have the right and the power and the money to fight that. And so we can put that in there. We also have clients who are very concerned that money that would go to their children for things that otherwise would be okay with them will end up being siphoned off by the spouse. And so we can put language or discuss language that says, if my trustee thinks that's what's happening, they have the right not to keep giving that money. And so you need to sort of really sit down with the client and talk about what that relationship is. And again, it goes from everything from the couple comes in together in the middle of their divorce to do their estate planning so that it's good for the kids, to the client comes in and says, you know, my wife, my husband is this horrible, horrible person who should have no rights and no access, and I want to be able to fight them essentially from the grave if necessary. And then you have lots of people in between who just say, look, they're fine. There won't be big fights, but I don't want them in charge of the money. And I occasionally have clients. I had a client who was going through a divorce, wanted the spouse out of everything, you know, not as a trustee, not as an anything. We want all the language to fight the spouse. And then, you know, 5 years later comes in and says, yeah, I was not in a great place right then with my spouse. Now I realize that if something happened to me, you know, he or she would use the money for the best interest of the kids. And so I'm, you know, I still want, don't want that person in charge of me and what happens to me. But if I'm gone, I do trust that they will, you know, do what's best for the kids. That, you know, my spouse had lots of problems, but taking care of our kids wasn't one of them. And so, you know, it may change over time as the relationship changes.
Years ago, I was had a client, and she was the beneficiary of a trust. It wasn't particularly large, but she didn't like the trustee. So upon the third lawsuit, I said to her, I said, you know who's paying for this? She goes, yeah, the trustee. And I go, no, you. I said, so you can sue as often as you like, but save it for a big one, not frivolous. And got a little mad at me, but she got the message and then became kind of very friendly. She would ask me, what about this or that? And certainly not second-guessing the trustee. And once the light bulb went off.
Well, the problem with that is in some of these cases, the spouse realizes they're not fighting with their own money. They're fighting with their kids' money.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, there are some parents out there who are okay doing that. And, you know, that's why you sort of sit down with the client and talk about that relationship and also nudge them to come back 3 years later or 5 years later and say, look, is that the same? Because it's not as, I mean, the most efficient thing is to have, you know, be able to have the person who's the guardian have a good relationship with the trustee and be sort of working together. And so ideally that's what you want to happen. But in the middle of the divorce, at the beginning of the divorce, right after the divorce, that's not often how the spouse feels. And so you're really not only into the trust for the kids, but into your own power of attorney. You're putting language that talks about giving other people the right to sort of use your money or the kids' money to deal with things that you think need to be dealt with vis-a-vis that other parent in that relationship.
Can you build anything in? We'll go to somebody that's been divorced and is going to be remarried, but let's take somebody that's never been married and they have a will. And is there any kind of language that says, if I get married, or is that too much? Is that too big, the word if?
It's too big a word if. I mean, not that we can't do it. We could. We could do essentially two entirely separate estate plans within a will or a trust that says, if married this, if not married that. It comes up more realistically when people are engaged. And so we'll have people come in sort of long-term engagements with a fiancé. And so they want it set up with the assumption that eventually by the time they die, because most people coming in feel strongly that they're immortal or that they're just going to die like the next day. It's one of the two. And so they assume that by the time they get married, by the time they die, they'll have been married. And so they want it to be done as though they're married and there's an identified person. And so that usually makes more sense. If you're in a relationship and the marriage just hasn't occurred yet, but it's headed that way, that's one thing. If it's a hypothetical spouse, I think it'd be hard to design an estate plan that takes them into account.
Okay, so you have a client that's not married and then finds the right person. And the right person really wanted their attorney, but because you're so affable and you speak English in a non-English environment, how do you... Initially, maybe the person comes, I won't say with a chip on their shoulder, but, you know, I'm going to his or her attorney and I really wanted to go to mine. How do you get over that?
You know, it's usually not so much a problem with that. I am so affable. So once they meet me, of course, they're happy. It used to be a problem more when I would do prenuptial agreements. Because you would be one party's attorney and the other party would have another attorney and there would be issues. And one of the things over the course of years, as I realized, is I want to be the estate planning attorney. I don't particularly want to be the prenuptial attorney. And so I'm much happier sort of planning with the couple together rather than starting in an adversarial position, because I've definitely had that where subsequently the spouse is not particularly thrilled with me because I was on the other side and I was telling their spouse, you know, well, here are all the downsides, not, you know, here's what you have to protect.
How do people take that? That's interesting.
The prenuptial?
No, that you say, listen, you all get that done somewhere else. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're not going to be quite this blunt. And I'm going to do the estate work. But I'm sure you weave it very, very well worded. But,
you know what? It comes down to the fact that you can't represent both people in a divorce or in a prenuptial agreement. And so what I said to them was, look, I would rather work with the two of you, and I'm happy to walk through some ideas about what a prenuptial might contain and what issues you want it to have. But ultimately, you're going to have to go to two separate people to create it, advocate for each of you, you know, in terms of what's best for each of you, and then sign it. And we can certainly integrate that into the planning that we're doing. And people are pretty good about that, I think. I think they understand that I can't do both, and I'd rather be doing the constructive part that works with both of them than the other part, which is by its nature sort of adversarial.
Wow. Okay. Good. I'm glad we got off on that. Remarriage. Somebody, Mark, you know, I'm going to get remarried. What do I need to know?
So, and actually, let me say one thing before that. The other thing that's important in the divorce process is when you're creating a separation agreement, to try and make sure that the estate planning attorney has had a chance to look at it. Because one of the things that often happens with young children is that there's life insurance and how that life insurance is set up. So sometimes the separation agreement will say the life insurance goes to the spouse, you know, with the idea that they would then use the money for the kids, but they're not required to. And so what we usually prefer is to say, well, it'll be going to a trust created for the kids. And sometimes it'll say that the spouse has to be the trustee of that trust and there has to have certain components to it. But that way, you know that the insurance money is going for the kids, not for the spouse. And so that's something, as you're doing your separation agreement, you want to make sure you talk to your estate planning attorney about, look, this is what these ongoing provisions will say. You want to make sure that those are fitted into, you know, what your estate plan is going to be and make sure those match up. When they come in, you know, after the fact and they're divorced and they're looking to get remarried, you know, there are a lot of issues and a lot of different scenarios. And that's where we sort of sit down with people and say, okay, what do we need this to look like? And the first thing we do is we look at, is there a separation agreement from a prior marriage? Is there something that has to be in your estate plan because you're required under the terms of your separation agreement to do that? For example, you're required to leave X amount of insurance for your kids or your former spouse. And so we have to make sure that fits into any new estate plan. But, you know, then we get to the issue of blended families. We get to the issue of, you know, one spouse has no kids, one spouse has three kids, both spouses have kids. How do we take care of each other? How do we take care of our kids? How do we be fair to each other? How do we be fair to our kids? And a lot of that has to do also with where the kids are in their lives. You know, if your kids are 5, 7, and 9, you're much more concerned about making sure that if something happens to you, you, in addition to taking care of your spouse, you have to take care of those minor children as well. Whereas the kids are 29, 27, and 26, I have a lot of clients who are not anywhere near as interested in making sure that things end up or provided for those adult children, and they're much more concerned about making sure their spouse is taken care of and that they're going to be able to, you know, live the life that they both imagined they would. And so where you are in your life, you know, if you have minor kids, it's almost always a situation where we're saying, okay, how do we make sure if you die, we take care of your kids and we take care of the spouse? And then with adult kids, it can be anything from the same exact thing where clients are like, no, I want to take care of these kids. They're the priority. They're my kids. My spouse has their own money. They can take care of themselves. To, you know, they're adults. Whatever they end up with, I don't care. It all goes to this person that I've been with for, you know, the last 5 years or 10 years, where I plan to be with for the next 20 or 30 years, rather than worrying about the adult kids. And then sort of everything in between.
So this plays right into your 3 or 5 year checkup.
Sure, because that may change over time.
Yeah.
You know, we say to a lot of clients, especially with small kids, you may create something when they're 5, 7, 9 that you're not going to change for 15 years. And then you may change it, you know, 3 times between the time they're 20 and 30, and you may not change it again after that. And so the ages of the kids, the length of this new relationship, both feed into things. You know, we have lots of situations where kids don't end up with what they expect because the money ends up going to the new spouse. And sometimes that is purposeful and sometimes that is not purposeful. And I get the phone call that says, you know, dad died and all the money's going to the stepmom instead of us and we want to sue. And, you know, my first question is always, well, how long was your dad married to your stepmom? And, you know, if they were married last Thursday in the hospital, you know, come on in, let's sit down and talk about what happened. And sometimes, well, you know, they were married for 25 years. You know, he has the right to leave everything to his bride of 25 years or groom of 25 years rather than necessarily to the kids.
There was a noted musician, I think it was last week, maybe it was the week before, that came out and said, we're not going to have any of these issues. We're going to spend it all.
Yeah, that was Sting, I believe.
Yeah, yes.
His fortune north of however many hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yeah, how are you going to spend that?
But I have some ideas for him. If he really wants to spend it all, I have some ideas on how he could do that. But yes, you know, you have to plan. I have lots of clients who say, well, it's not going to matter how much money we have today because we're going to spend it all before we die, which is great. But we have to plan as if something's going to happen to you next year or 2 years from now or 5 years from now, not that something's going to happen to you 30 years from now when you've managed to spend it all away. And so we're going to assume, and I guarantee you that Sting's estate planning attorney assumes in his planning that something happens to them tomorrow or next week or 2 years from now when there are still hundreds of millions of dollars to deal with, because I don't think he can spend it that quickly.
No, I wouldn't imagine. Let me go on not the reverse side of this, but look at it from another angle. Do you get clients that come in and say, you know, I've got $1 million worth of life insurance and that's a lot, and in the back of your, not in the back, in the front of your mind, you go, no, it's not, because they have a child or two or even a spouse. And if they happen to be the, if you will, greater earner than the other one, how do you convince somebody that just thinks life insurance? I'm not a life insurance salesperson, but I learned a long time ago that, you know, X dollars really isn't that much if you have to care for somebody for 15 years, 45 years.
So the first thing I say is, I don't sell life insurance. I have no dog in this fight. You know, if you want to get more life insurance, it's not going to be from me. And then what I say is, I can't tell you how much life insurance you need. I can tell you what other similarly situated people have, because that is what I see. I see, you know, hundreds of, you know, thousands of clients over my lifetime of what people have in general that are similarly situated to you, and they have more. And, you know, here are some of the things you need to think about, not just replacing income, but, you know, your spouse may not want to work as much. You know, even if you're the greater earner, look at what the other spouse is making in terms of whatever they contribute financially, and then think about what it would cost to replace that person in terms of what they do for the family. And think about the fact that you may not want to work as much. You may want to take some time off. You want to be able to vary your schedule, perhaps, or go into a different area or a different agency or a different job within an agency that is going to allow you to be home more. You know, so I have a lot of clients who travel for work. Well, they may not want to do that anymore, and that may affect their earning potential and what they can do. And so life insurance is a way to hedge that. It's not generally, for most people in those situations, an investment. It's generally sort of something that's there for the worst case scenario. And so you just try and walk through what that money does and why you would need it. And most people are then going to take the next step, because the next thing I say is, look, go out and see what it costs. Go find out what it's going to cost to get more, and then figure out how that fits into your life, because ultimately they have to pay the bill every month, not me. And so I can say you should have more insurance, but I'm not paying that bill. So they've got to go forward and find out how much they can get and how much it would cost, and does it make sense? And, you know, then if you're getting a divorce, make sure you change those designations and make sure that the money is going to go where you want it to go at that point, rather than to that spouse that you would not want to have it.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a question. Let's say you've had this client for a while, good client, listens to you, of course, and they bring in this potential nearly spousal material, and you look and you go, I think I don't like what I see. How do you work that? I mean, you can't very well call your client up and say, are you nuts? But yeah, I mean, then you won't have a client. But
yeah, no, you have to respect their decisions about who they want to spend their life with. I think that the question for attorneys and other people in our sort of the way we interact with our clients is protecting themselves and talking about a prenuptial agreement. A lot of my clients don't want to do a prenuptial agreement because they feel like with a prenup, you're planning for a divorce. And as I say in all the classes, I don't know if you're going to get divorced. I know you're going to die. And prenups deal as much with death as they do with divorce. I've actually seen a few, not a lot, but a few prenuptial agreements that don't mention the word divorce and they don't mention the word separation. They just say, look, I've got stuff, you've got stuff. I have kids, you have kids. Let's agree ahead of time on what happens at the first death, what happens at the second death, and have that document there. That's the plan ahead of time. Now, what normally happens when you suggest that is that they're also going to deal with what if there's a divorce and what if there's a separation. But the entry point into the conversation for a lot of clients is one of us is going to die, you know, first, and one of us is going to die second, and we need to plan for that, and a prenup is the best way to plan for that. And that's often the entryway into the conversation about the rest of it, because the domestic attorney is always going to say, or the attorney doing the prenup is always going to say, all right, now what about these other issues about divorce and separation, and what about alimony, and what about marital property, and go through all those other scenarios as well.
Very smart move.
It's a lot easier to talk about the fact that, hey, you are going to die than to imply that your marriage isn't going to last.
Wow. I like that. All right. Setting up trust. We got another email, a local person who writes very good emails, and I'll read it. Now that the federal tax exemption is north of $5 million, how closely is IRS policing crummy letter issuance? And we'll go back to what crummy letter is. I am currently being very cautious. Generally, monthly crummy letters for monthly deposits into irrevocable life insurance trust, we'll talk about that too, owned accounts, giving the ILIT, another one, beneficiaries a fixed time to exercise their withdrawal option and having them sign the letter. As trustees, must I maintain hard copy of these letters? So first, what's an estate?
Well, so when he's talking about the federal estate tax exemption is set over or north of $5 million, what he's talking about is the federal estate tax exemption, which currently is $5.34 million this year. It's going to go up every year. Last year it was $5.25 million. Next year it'll be somewhere north of $5.4 million. And that is the amount under which you do not have to file an estate tax return or pay an estate tax. And so the shortcut, the easiest way to know what you have and whether it's over $5.3 million is assume everything you have and everything that passes at your death is going to be included in that number. Now, that isn't necessarily true. There are some exceptions, but add up the gross value of any real estate, all liquid assets, all joint assets, one half of assets owned with your spouse, and all sorts of other bits out there. Your TSP is included, a 401k is included. Life insurance proceeds are included, and we'll come back to that in a second, so that if you have $1 million of life insurance, that's included in your estate as well. There are other things. Your annuity is technically included, so your pension. And so you add all that up. And if it's under $5.3 million at its highest possible number, you're done. You don't have to file a federal estate tax return. You may want to for other reasons, if it's a spousal situation and it's the first to die, but you don't have to. And so, you know, one of the things that people do to try and stay under that number is they look at their life insurance and say, well, this term life insurance doesn't do anything for me while I'm alive. I don't care if I own it. I don't care if I control it. And so what you can do is take that term life insurance and put it into what's called an irrevocable life insurance trust, or ILIT for short. And you put that in there. And as long as it's either purchased originally in there or it's in there for 3 years before you die, IRS will agree that you didn't own it, it's not yours, you didn't control it, you didn't retain control over it, and so therefore we don't count it as part of your estate. So it's a quick and easy way to get life insurance proceeds out of your estate for estate tax purposes. It's more technical than we're going to get into, but there was a case called Crummy versus the Commissioner. And it's a C-R-U-M-M-E-Y. I'm not sure actually that's the spelling in the case, but that case said that if you give the beneficiaries the right to the premium when you put it in the trust, that's one of the things that gets those premium payments and the proceeds out of your estate for estate tax purposes. And that's as much as we're going to get into for this. So at the end of the day, you send out these letters to people, and you have to tell them you have the right to the premium. What he's asking about is, you know, how closely is that looked at? If your estate's under the $5.3 million, it's not going to matter because you're not going to have to file an estate tax return. If it's over, the technical requirements that IRS has, it just depends on whether you're getting audited or not and whether or not it catches their eye. I would do it exactly as you're doing it now. I would continue to do that, and I'd continue to maintain hard copies. And really anything else, you'd want to sit down with your attorney and talk specifically about, in my particular case, what do I need to do?
Okay, let me make sure I understand it. If somebody wants to, if you will, peel off the life insurance policy that they own personally and put it into one of these trusts, I'm going to say it's not that difficult. So the life insurance policy goes into this thing called a trust. But then the premium dollars, you know, where's the money going to come from? Somebody puts the money in to pay it, but it's like a checking account. So they put the money into the checking account, and it has to stay there for a certain number of days because the certain number of days, they're going to have to pay the premium. So this is how it's funded, and if, unfortunately, the reason that you set it up happens, then the life insurance proceeds go into this, quote, trust, but it doesn't go into the person's personal assets, and it keeps it outside of the estate,
yes.
Generally.
Yeah.
Okay. And the other thing is, and you very accurately mentioned that an individual's annuity is going to be added into the estate, but if it's going to a spouse, it gets subtracted right back out. Because I'm seeing people go, oh, my God, now I'm over the 5 point whatever, because, you know, federal annuities got a really nice value.
However, if the spouse is not a U.S. citizen, it's not going to automatically be deducted out of their estate for estate tax purposes.
Then you've got to go see somebody like you if one of the spouses is not a U.S. citizen. I can't even imagine how you do that.
I mean, it's complicated. And yeah. It certainly is made much easier by the fact that the exemption is much higher than it used to be. And it's easier by the fact that the Maryland exemption is going up and other states are following suit. So throughout the country, more and more state estate taxes are going up to meet the federal exemption, which creates a lot of cushion because most people don't reach $5.34 million or more as part of as their gross estate when they die.
Well, I'll just take a tangent on here. Today is kind of the last day to file forms if you have a foreign bank account, and it's got to be e-filed, and they're really pounding on the bank's doors, and the banks are opening. Been involved with a few, and I would have never guessed it. But especially if somebody's married to somebody's not a U.S. citizen, and not saying that they all hide money offshore, but there's some blood in the IRS's eyes. And I'm not saying that that's bad. I mean, somebody should pay taxes on what they're supposed to.
Well, no, I've heard of some situations where the person doesn't even know they have the account. In other words, the grandparent, the parent creates an account, puts money in it as a gift, puts their name on the account or something like that, and suddenly they're subject to all the reporting requirements they never knew existed. And so that is, you know, that creates problems as well. And in a way that is, again, not hiding money at all, you know, grandpa never told you that he put this money in an account with your name on it. And suddenly you have this issue.
Yeah, I had one of them. They just had amnesia until the agent came in.
Yes, I mean, I think there are people who are purposefully unaware, but there have been some cases of people who are just genuinely unaware.
Yeah.
When they were kids, the account was set up, and they had no idea.
Wow. All righty, 202-465-3080. We always like one call, don't we?
Sure.
And you can ask finance, tax, certainly the better question would be to take advantage of Mark and ask estate planning questions.
Yeah, you know, I think, again, going back to the blended family thing is the thing we spend a lot of time with clients because there are a lot of people who are in second marriages, who have children from their prior relationships. I have clients who want to take care of their stepchildren.
All right, could I ask you a question about special needs trusts?
Sure.
They're set up for a child, or I guess suppose it could be an adult that has special needs, and the money goes in there. What happens if the issue that caused the special needs is cured? What do they do with the trust? Do they leave it in place? Do they dissolve it? Is it written such that if the miracle cure is found for this, that the trust can go elsewhere?
Well, so, you know, when you talk about special needs trust, and primarily when we deal with them, we're dealing with them as what we would call a third-party trust, which is mom and dad leaving a trust for a child or for a niece or for somebody else, as opposed to a self-settled trust where someone's in an accident and they get an award from the court, and so they put money into a trust for themselves, or the court approves it or something like that. So in the third-party trust, mom and dad have a child with special needs. You know, the first thing you have to figure out is this child ever going to qualify for government benefits? Is that need such that we need to be concerned about their eligibility for means-tested programs? In other words, programs where they won't get money and they won't get services if they have too much money or too much access to money. And so a lot of times I have clients who come in and say, well, I want a special needs trust. And what they really mean is they want a permanent trust. They want a trust that's going to be there for this child for the rest of their life because maybe they have a need in terms of their ability to handle money or make some decisions, but can basically live their lives. And so they want someone who would control this large sum of money for them for the rest of their lives. That is not any different necessarily from a trust we would do for anyone if that person had a spending problem or a drug problem or other issues. The other side, and what people usually mean when they say a special needs trust, is a child who would qualify for government benefits, government services, and if they have too much money, they won't qualify. They won't qualify for the assistance. And so what mom and dad want to do is protect this money from being lost to pay for the services that the government otherwise would provide for. And so these trusts basically have to be set up not to provide for the essential needs of the child. They have to be set up only to provide for the supplemental needs, for the extra needs, for the things that the government doesn't provide. And there are some specific exceptions to that and other things that you can do. But basically, that's what it's set up. It's set up not to be for their essential day-to-day needs. And so now what happens if this child grows up and they don't need that kind of protection? They are not going to qualify for a government benefit because they're, you know, cured may be the wrong word, but they have developed the ability to do things without needing them. And so you can have trusts that have some flexibility. The problem is if they have too much flexibility, a court could come in and say, no, this is not a special needs trust. This is a support trust. This is a trust that really is for this person's benefit. Part of the problem with special needs trust is, although it's federal money, they're administered state by state by state. And so different states can have different rules in terms of how they interpret trusts, and different states do have different rules in terms of how they interpret trusts. So sometimes if we know that the child's going to be in a particular state, we just did this in Pennsylvania, these are adults, they are long-term, you know, there's not going to be the ability for them to be on their own. And so we actually went to a Pennsylvania attorney and said, look, we want something that works in Pennsylvania. And so we're going to pay you to provide the language we need for this. And so you have to make sure that you go to someone who is familiar with that state's rules so that they can craft it with the most flexibility possible while still allowing for what would happen. Comes back to that checkup idea, though, that you talked about before, because what you fear at 5 for the child or at 10 for the child, you may feel differently about at 15 or 20 as they develop more ability than you thought they would. And so you may have special needs trust at 5 that's set up that really isn't what you want anymore when they're 15 and you look at how they actually will be able to conduct themselves and carry themselves and what they'll be able to do. So it's definitely the kind of thing where you want to talk specifically with someone who does this every day in that state.
All right. How about before we close out, some real life comments? In other words, a client comes in and there might be a mental hurdle with them as I don't want to do this, but you feel really they should. I mean, you have no obligation to make them do it, but how do you, I mean, I deal with it all day long. I want to deduct dog food. You can't deduct dog food. Well, it guards my house. That's nice, but you can't do it. And sometimes they get mad. I won't tell that story. Anyway, how do you, I won't say turn them around, because you don't want to turn them around. You just want to make them see the light.
You know, it's a question of very often the conversation that we have. People ask me all the time, why can't I just go online and do a will? Why can't I just buy it from the Staples or from Office Depot and do it to, you know, fill in the blank? It's the questions that you ask. It's the conversation you have. I have people who come in and say, well, I'm just going to have all my kids joint on everything, and I'm going to make them joint powers of attorney and joint personal representatives. And my first question is, great, do your kids get along? And very often the answer is, well, sometimes. No, not really. No, two of them don't talk to each other. And so you start sort of walking down the repercussions of what their plan is, because there's always a plan in place. In other words, if you don't do estate planning, there's a plan. In Maryland, Annapolis has decided what your plan is. In Virginia, Richmond has decided. In New York, Albany has decided what your plan is. And so when you do estate planning, you are substituting their plan for your plan. You're deciding for yourself, rather than the default of what the state thinks should happen if I'm incapacitated or gone. I'm going to put something in place that says what happens. And so it's a case of making people aware of that. You know, not deciding is a decision. And so then walking through what would happen. I'd say the biggest obstacle for a lot of clients is who's going to be the guardian for our kids when they have minor kids, and they can't agree on who that person is. And it's sort of very sobering to say to them, look, someone's going to be. You know, you want this person, you want this person. Either the two of you decide, or it could be that those two people will fight, because someone's going to step in and be the guardian of this child. And if you want to decide who that will be, then you've got to do that. And you've got to just decide on, you know, not letting perfect get in the way of better, and making sure that there's a clear path, even if it's not a perfect path. And so you just sort of walk through with them the repercussions of the decisions or the lack of decision that they make, and they'll turn themselves around usually, because as you walk through it, they'll figure out, oh, this isn't really what I would want to happen. A client of mine said that I spend all of my life dealing with morbid improbabilities, all the horrible things that could go wrong. And as you start walking people down those paths, they realize, you know, we can't just plan for the probable, we have to plan for the improbable. And very often doing that is all it takes. I don't really usually have to turn people around. I usually just have to talk to them about what it is that there is now and what would happen if something happened. And occasionally I have clients who say, I don't need to do that. I have my will from online, and I have this, and I don't need to worry about all that, because in my case it'll all work out fine.
How does somebody contact you?
Our phone number is 301-961-6464. My extension is 3313. Our website, www.handlerlevine.com, HANDLERLEVINE.com. And my email, Mark with a C, MARC, at handlerlevine.com, HANDLERLEVINE.com. And that's how you get in touch with me.
Okay, great. And the final question, because we're finding more and more younger feds are listening and coming into the classrooms, you probably see the same thing.
Yeah.
What advice do you have there? I mean, we don't have a lot of time. You could probably spend a whole hour on that. But, you know, they don't know. And, you know, wills, I don't need that. I don't need this. When do they start thinking about what we've been talking about? I guess prior to marriage, but you tell me.
Well, powers of attorney and health care directive you need from the day you turn 18. In other words, you know, no one has the right to make financial, legal, and healthcare decisions for you once you're an adult. And so if you care who's going to make those decisions, you need to do that tomorrow. In terms of a will, look at what you have, look at where it would go. Because again, there's a plan. It'll go somewhere. And if you're not happy with where it would go, if you have three siblings and two of them are irresponsible or have a drug problem or have other issues, look and see, look, it's going to go to them. And is that okay with you? And if it's not, then you've got to come in and do planning. You've got to set up something that says, instead of it going to my brother, it's going to go to my nephew. And because my nephew's a minor, it's going to go to him in trust. And, you know, think about who ends up with everything. Who is it that has to step in and clean up the mess? Who has to sell things? Who has to pay my last tax return? And how easy can I make it for them to do that? And that's really, when you're thinking about that, is when you're going to go and do a power of attorney, a will, a healthcare directive, so that A, people know what you want, and B, they have the power to carry it out.
Wow. Great show. Thanks. Clear, concise, to the point responses to a very confusing subject for most people, including the one sitting across from you. Anyway, thanks for coming. And next week, we're going to have Mike Causey and Tammy Flanagan. And we do two shows a year. We do other shows, but we look in January at the year coming, and then we have a mid-year review. So next Monday, I guess that'd be the 7th of July, we'll be on. Other than that, you all have a good week, and thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.